We're recording for a future broadcast on WPKN, a totally non-commercial radio station out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. Welcome, everybody. We're delighted to have you. Very special occasion this evening, celebrating the poetry of Bill Knott. It's an amazing weekend for our celebration, and this came together very quickly, our event this evening. But if you saw the current issue of the New Yorker magazine, and if you saw the Sunday New York Times book review, there are two notices, you know, important notices and reviews of this beautiful new book, a collection posthumously published, poetry by Bill Knott, I Am Flying Into Myself. It has an introduction by the poet Thomas Lux. I may read just one or two little snippets from that introduction for you. How many people have some familiarity with Bill Knott's poetry? And it's okay if you don't, that's why you're here to learn. Okay, that's great, that's great. I was a young student once attempting to be a poet and was encouraged to come to a reading that Bill Knott gave in, who can remember, the late 70s, early 80s. My dear friend Robert Long, a wonderful East Hampton poet, was hosting this event, and here comes this tall, scraggly Bill Knott with long hair and the most amazing poems, you know, I'd ever heard as a young person attempting to be a poet. It was just an immediate connection, an immediate resonance. These were the poems that, you know, I would have loved to have written. That was a long time ago. I actually wrote Bill a fan letter. And he did write back. I have to find the letter somewhere. Fast forward, it's now 2002. Catherine and I have taken over the bookshop, unbelievably as all that is. And Bill came and gave a reading here. Star Black was here with us and made the introduction. And it was a tremendous thrill to have Bill standing right about here. He put together this beautiful little booklet of the poems that he read for that event. We have a few copies left over for sale. We have some very special books of Bill's work here. Joining the main program will be readings by Star Black, a wonderful poet, and Bill Zawadzki, another wonderful poet, who was kind enough to come out from New York on very short notice. And both Star and Bill have long and reverent connections with Bill Knott, so they'll speak to you and they'll read some of his poetry. Again, it's been a pleasure. I'm delighted that this book has come out, and just rereading some of the poems has made me understand again how extraordinary, how absolutely unique Bill Knott in his work is, like no other. Just a few quick lines from the editor's introduction about Bill. He was a hardcore, card-carrying surrealist, a poet of stunning lyric tenderness, and he was a brilliant and innovatively traditional metricist, sometimes all three at once. In his so-called free verse poems, Bill Knott pays fierce attention to pacing, diction, tone, syntax, line breaks, and always noises, sonics, music, sounds. He agreed with Robert Frost, who said, "Words exist in the mouth, not in books." His intense focus on every syllable and the sound of every syllable in relation to nearby sounds is so skilled that the poems often seem casual. Art hides art. He writes for the voice and the page equally. You know, in rereading some of the poetry, I thought of Emily Dickinson, a poet I love, and then I came to learn that that Bill Knott was an avid reader of her work. So, not to take too much time here, I want to just read two poems, okay? And then I'm going to turn it over to Star and then to Bill. A parable from childhood. Something about a pond, and on the pond a paper boat. Something about a child's act, dropping a pebble upon that boat to study the effect, but then to let other pebbles fall to see if it holds, to kneel there, spilling them one after one, until finally, if I weigh this poem down with much more, it too will sink. Writing my poems of a boy on the brink has shown how ripples horizoned by sky remain the only real cargo aboard whatever that craft that unmoored us was. And yet why he treasured such passages, saying they be lost, we would launch each word. It's not always easy to read them out loud, but one more. There are a couple of water poems here, but I want to pick this poem called Plunge. This reminds me of Emily. At night, one drop of rain falls from each star as if it were being lowered on a string. And yet that storm of plummets is never enough to wet any of the planets that pass through it. Only the blackness, the space between us, is washed away by these singular lettings down of water. Distance is washed away, all the worlds merge for a liquid moment, our island eyes. And suddenly we understand why umbrellas love to dive into clouds. Just two tiny samples of some very beautiful work. I want to welcome Star Black up here. She has a beautiful collaboration with Bill Knott, Star's collages and Bill's poetry with an introduction by Mark Doty. Star is a beautiful poet in her own right and has a very special connection to Bill Knott. So please welcome Star Black.
Thank you for coming. Bill and I were friends for 30 years, and he was sort of the love of my life. And there's a picture of us. He came and was in Sag Harbor and stayed with me here one summer. And we read here together. And I'm thrilled that there's the not hour is here. You know, he's being reviewed everywhere. There's a beautiful new book of his collected works, which is wonderful. And there's also a small book with essays on a small press, Tiger Bark Press, of people who knew and loved Bill like I did. So the thing about Bill was he was a character. He was incredibly smart, and he had the distance from poetry to make the poetry world clear. And in the New Yorker recently, his ability to distance himself and his brilliance had a lot to do with his power to see all the irrealities out there in poetry and to hone in specifically to the truth of everything. And I just wanted to say that Bill didn't like his picture taken, and he didn't, wasn't that kind of person. He was a very private person. And yet this is a conceptual photograph that he takes in the form of a poem. It's really beautiful. And if you can imagine it, it's a brilliant photograph. It's called Click. From the bottom of my well, I see the sun and moon just once a day, which is nothing when compared to you above, who see them both so often, so open-shared, so totally. Yet I believe that in that instant, when daily the sun and monthly the moon fill my circle rim up there, I am illuminated in a way you can never be, quenched entirely and all sealed in light. See, I'm whole now, no cracks in me. And this is taking the same theme of photography, combining it with his legendary humor about everything, because he's very funny and wickedly funny, and Hollywood, and the form of the sestina. Susan is here. She's written one. It's a complicated form that repeats N words 6 times in 6 stanzas. So this is called, he would watch TV all the time, and he loved all the Hollywood shows about movie stars and what they were wearing and, you know, and what awards they were getting. And he was an indoor guy. He was like an indoor cat. He liked a lot of TV. He didn't like to go out. He didn't like to go out because he had tinnitus and noise bothered him. So he didn't like restaurants. And when he went to movies, he'd always go to matinees when nobody was in the theater. So, and he went often. He loved movies. He loved the whole thing. So this is called Hollywood Nightmare. Soon to be a major mirage. My face never changes. To look each day in the mirror is boring as going on location shoots or signing autographs for my stable of fans or being typecast into detective roles, sigh. Sometimes all I do is sit by my pool and spaz out until my brain is a black pool of emptiness. My eyes reruns until my face wears the neutral mask of aura a detective affects. And when I am blank as a mirror, as dull, when I sprawl as snoozeful as a stable full of saviors, I dream. I dream someone shoots me and becomes a celebrity. He shoots me and he gets the house, the swimming pool, the Andy Warhols, the Rolls, the Porsche, the stable, the lawn he gets. Christ, it's like a divorce. My face. He gets my face too? He's like a fucking mirror of me. Jesus, you'd think some goddamn detective would know it's not me. When I'm a detective on screen, I know who is who. The bad guy shoots the good guy sometimes, but when they hold a mirror over the good guy's lips, you see a pool of mist appear. And then his pal, the co-star's face, looks all relieved. Cut to the hospital. Stable? The doctor smirks. Yes, his condition is stable. Of course, with the brainectomy, his detective days are history. Uh-huh. His face, hell, our plastic surgeon loves challenge. Shoots these before and after photos, great stuff. The pool of reporters from the Daily Sun rhymes mirror, yawns at the grinning doctor, while the mirror above my white bed, I maintain a stable, noble absence. My non-being is a pool of pure mystery, a sheer puzzle any detective would arrest the cursed creator of. I see shoots of lilacs and crocus come bursting out of my face each time the mirror close ups, but no detective can solve this daily dream whose stable cam shoots me here beside my pool, here, inside my face. Bill is most known from these beautiful, beautiful love poems that he wrote throughout his life. He's one of the great American love poets. And I just want to read the last paragraph of Tom Luck's essay on Bill, because I think this is what's happening. I believe Bill Knott stood out in the rain and was struck by lightning at least a dozen or two times to qualify, using Randall Jarrell's formula metaphor, as a great poet. He is one, in a school of one, among the American poets. I believe this will become more and more evident, maybe even obvious, if these kinds of things continue to matter in our culture, as the decades, like barges, keep moving toward the sea. So he became very well known in his 20s when he wrote a book called The Naomi Poems, Corpse and Beans. But as Bill knows well, and we have one of his publishers in the house, which is wonderful, and we have these rare books accumulating already, like his little mimeographs of his reading that he made here, he was highly influenced by European and international poets at a time that America was in the deep image poem of kind of post-Williams grit. And Bill came in from a whole new perspective of surrealistic sort of magic. And the Naomi, he wrote these poems to Naomi, who in fact, well, no poem is really to another person altogether. It's always a poem. But Naomi Lazard, a poet at that time and a very good poet, is here in East Hampton. And so we're all kind of in this world of 6 degrees of separation. And so here's a poem probably written in the 1960s when Bill was in his 20s from the Naomi book. The Naomi poem, the starfish one. Each evening the sea casts starfish up on the beach, scattering, stranding them. They die at dawn, leaving black hungers in the sun. We slept there that summer. We fucked in their radiant evolutions up to our body, ringed by starfish, gasping for their element. We joined to create ours. All night they inhaled the sweat from our thrusting limbs and lived. Often she cried out, "Your hand, it was a starfish caressing her with my low fire." And the last poem I'll read is another poem to a woman, a New York artist that Bill wrote in the 60s named Marjorie Portnow. Mm-hmm. And throughout his life, Bill always returned to painting, and I think it was the influence of this woman. And now he's writing later in his life, and he's writing a poem about the process of visual art, the painting. It's called Sunset and Noon, Marjorie P. Each face strikes a different hour in the heart. The final tolling, it will be yours. This, its profile panels on which are sleep-lacquered eye, the golden flights and returns of an unblemished wound. Like a blind person reading smoke signals, I touch the face foretold as yours. It's like a bony honey in the sunset, pale laughter of leeches, a teardrop, that Rosetta pebble, leading to the eventual decipherments of all things in the sky, sunset and noon. And if you've started thinking about now that this is a long line, you're wrong, because this is no line. This is a caress. And it won't stop until it reaches your smile of permanent collisions. Pale laughter of leeches, the still unblemished wound, then to rise by noon when the horizon's tug of war is raging, to sink by noon in a white studio embracing. The sky, directionless as children who keep getting kissed on the tops of their heads. They turn this way and that, dizzy, mad. Thank you.
I'm going to read every page in all of these books. So I hope you're ready. I was lucky enough to, I published for about 10 years a small press called Sun, not to be confused with Sun and Moon, thank you. And I began to badger Bill, which is a funny enough phrase, for a book. And he, finally we talked, and he said, well, you know, I wanted to do a collected poems, but I only have about 55 pages that I want to do. And everybody tells me my collected poem should be a minimum of 120 pages. So I said, well, you know, let's talk about it. So we started looking through his books, and we did the 55 pages, which was the selected poems. And then we did the collected poems, which was brought us up to 121 pages. So that's what we did. And I can't tell you, you know, if my name completely goes into the dust, at least in some way it will be associated with Bill's name and the name of a few other poets that you might know. Maybe his most famous poem, and it's the poem that gives its part of itself to the selected poems. And let's please remember, this is a selected poems. It's not a complete poems. So maybe someday we'll get a complete poems of Bill, which would be quite an amazing thing. But this poem is called Death. Going to sleep, I cross my hands on my chest. They will place my hands like this. It will look as though I am flying into myself. Pretty amazing. You know, I'd love to read every poem here, but here's one called My Mother's List of Names. My mother's list of names, today I take it in my hand. And I read the places she underlined, William and Anne. The others are my brothers and sisters. I know I'm going to see them when I'm fully grown. Yes, they're waiting for me to join them, and I will, just over the top of that next big hill. Lies a green valley where their shouts of joy are fellowing, save all but one can be seen there next of kin. And a link is missing from their ring a rosy dance. Think of the names she wrote down, not just by chance. When she learned that a baby inside her was growing small, she placed that list inside the family Bible. Then I was born and she died soon after. And I grew up sinful of questions I could not ask her. I did not know that she had left me the answer. Pressed between the holy pages with the happy laughter of John, Rudolph, Frank, Arthur, Paul, Pauline, Martha, Anne, Doris, Susan, you all. I did not even know you were alive till I read the Bible today for the first time in my life. And I found this list of names that might have been my own, you other me's on the bright side of my moon. Mother and Daddy, too, have joined you in play. And I am coming to complete the circle of your day. I was a lonely child. I never understood that you were waiting for me to find the truth and know, and I'll make this one promise you want me to. I'm going to continue my Bible study till I'm back inside the body with you. Aunt Dodger. A suicide applicant who braces himself out on a high ledge at noon while busy peeking down noticed an ant crawling dottily on the ledge right there near his left toe. Below, crowds pushed, oblivious, babbling, omniscient like in the movies, out whooshy doors. But his gaze, halt, ant, the true ant, he dimly remembers, not like them. So now he hesitates, a million stories up, shifts weight, trying make his mind up, distantly deciding whether to step before he jumps on it or not. Unbelievable poem. Another very famous poem of Bill's is called Goodbye. Some of his greatest poems were two or three lines long. Goodbye. If you are still alive when you read this, close your eyes. I am under their lids, growing black. This is the book I put. This was selected and collected poems, by the way. Not available. One of his poems that I love the most, and which somehow did not end up in the selected poems, I don't believe, I couldn't find it, was, I think it's just called Poem. Or maybe it might be, later he called it, I think, at the Crossroads, or the Crossroads. I mean, he was always fiddling with his poems. The poem goes like this. The wind blows a piece of paper to my feet. I pick it up. It is not a petition for my death. Does that give you a sense of the internal, Bill's internal struggles? You may or may not know that he had a terrible childhood and teenage years. His mother died when he was very young. His father put him and his sister in an orphanage, and then the father killed himself. Oh, God. And then Bill was evidently terribly abused in all kinds of ways in this orphanage. Then they put him in a nut house, and that's his language. I'm not being disrespectful. And the same thing happened to him there. And then he was rescued by an uncle, and he lived with the uncle for a few years, and then he joined the army. And when he got out of the army, I don't know when he started writing poetry. Did you ever have any sense of when he started writing poetry?
Yeah, he moved to Chicago. He got out of his childhood and moved to Chicago and worked as an orderly in a hospital
And
began reading poetry, and he thanks the poet, I think, John Logan.
Oh, yeah, John Logan was one of his teachers.
Naomi Lazard in that workshop, and John Logan helped him along. Yeah.
Did you know John Logan at all?
No.
Yeah, I knew him a little bit. He was a very sweet man.
And this was Chicago.
A teacher, yeah. But then Logan ended up at the State University of New York at Buffalo. That was his last gig. Anyhow. He was a big influence, as was Paul Carroll, another poet who brought out Bill's first two books. There's something else you should know about Bill, and I can only invoke... Oh, shucks, it's in my bag.
Let me grab something?
Yeah, if you could find the book, Autonecrophilia. That was his second book.
Where was he?
Autonecrophilia.
Michigan?
Yeah, he was born in a little town in Michigan. And here's the table of contents from Autonecrophilia, which is the Bill always had women often on his on the covers of his books. And the first one, Naomi poems, Corpse and Beans, was there's this beautiful Harry Callahan photo of a woman rising with her eyes closed out of the water or going into the water, black hair, eyes closed. It's a magnificent photograph. It was Callahan's wife, and that was on the first book. And this second book, also published by Paul Carroll, tells us something really important about Bill. And you can see this in the first book. I was disappointed in this selected poems. I'm sorry to have to say this in a bookstore that's trying to sell it. But I think it should have been done book by book. That's how I think it would have worked best. Because you could have seen development, but you don't necessarily see that now. But it's still an important book to have, and you better buy it if you want to get out of this bookstore alive. I'm talking to you. So here's the table of contents of this book. And these all appear to be one-page poems. Gorgo, Attack of the Puppet People, The Blob, Godzilla, The Manster. These are all real names of science fiction movies, horror movies. The Mole People, The Atomic Monsters, Mothra, a Japanese sci-fi movie, The Giant Killer Shrews, Invasion of the Giant Crabs, Reptilicus, Konga, I Married a Monster from Outer Space, one of my favorite movies, by the way. The Gamma People, The Monster at the World's End, and so forth and so on. And that's the table of contents for two pages. So, but you won't find that in selected poems. But what does this tell us about Bill? Bill was a classic trickster. You know? And you know that the classic trickster figure in the U.S. is what they call out west they call him coyote. Here we call it a coyote. There's probably some around here, right? Some around here. And Bill, I think, had to learn because of his terrible early life. He had to learn how to lay low. He had to learn how to stay quiet, how to stay to the ground, how to not be noticed. And both of these articles, the one in the Times Tomorrow book review and the one in the New Yorker, he's the outsider, he's the outlier, he's the whatever. Well, you have to, if you're going to try to survive the kinds of things that he lived through when he was a kid, you have to, and you know about the coyotes. When they tried to get rid of the coyotes out west, the ranchers would take a carcass, a lamb carcass, and they'd fill it with poison. And the wolves would come, and the wolves would eat it, and they would die. And the coyotes would come, and they'd sniff around it, and they'd walk around it, and they'd watch what was happening, and they would go away, and they survived. They survived so much that they're among us, you know? So this archetype, Jung talks a lot about the trickster. This archetype is a survival archetype, and but all the trickster stories are full of humor, you know? Trickster is often incredibly stupid. He sees these little leaves falling out of the trees. And he says, "That's nice. Look at that." And he goes over to the leaves. He says, "How do you do that? It's very easy. We just jump down from the tree." And Coyote says, "I'm going to do that." And he climbs up the tree and he jumps out of the tree and he kills himself. But these figures never die. So gradually, over the course of a few seasons, he you know, his bones start to knit together and so forth and so on. And then he's off to his next adventure. Bill also was a wonderful poet, not only of love, but of eros. His poems were the sexiest people. Nobody was writing sexy, erotic poems in the world I grew up in. I'm only a few years younger than Bill. And it was astounding to see what he was doing, what he was the material he was using, what he was getting away with. And I'm gonna try to do something that you can hear him do on YouTube. And this will give you a little sense of that. And this is called Golly Mountain Blues. Okay. You can hear him sing this on YouTube. He does it a lot better than I do, but I'm going to try it. Okay, Golly Mountain Blues. You ready?
Yeah.
Okay. You can clap if you want. No. All right. Up on Golly Mountain, all the lovers are parked. Wish we could be up there enjoying the dark. But you don't wanna. I'm sorry I come along. 'Cause you won't stop the car, hun, all night long. Hairpin turns up and down the mountainside. Hairpin turns, driving like a suicide. I know you ain't to blame, but our love's about to flame out. Can't you smell the rubber burn as you keep riding them hairpin turns? When you told me you loved danger, I said, I'm your guy. I've been dangerous since I first learned to kiss. Let's go up on Golly and give it a try. But when I said I loved it, I sure didn't mean this. Hairpin turns up and down the mountainside. Hairpin turns, driving like a suicide. I can't remember your name, but Arlo's about to flame out. Can't you feel the floorboards burn as you keep riding them hairpin turns? I heard about some funny ways that people get their kicks from running around upon the town to getting hit with whips. But you take the cake, my friend, you're oddball number one. I admire your nerves, but I got some curves where you could have more fun than these here hairpin turns up and down the mountainside. Hairpin turns, driving like a suicide. I guess it's all the same, but our love's about to flame out. Can't you taste the seat of my blue jeans burn as you keep riding them hairpin turns? Bill says, you know, there's always a talking part in a country western song. And here's the talking part. Poor baby, I know it ain't your fault. It was your mama, daddy must have dropped you on your brake when you was born. Because if you don't know that loving is the deadliest thrill there is, you don't know nothing. I should have known something when you picked me up inside the movie show. The way your windshield wiper kept getting into my popcorn. Here, let me take these hairpins out of my hair and let it fall down into your lap. Don't that make you want to love me and cuddle and lay your head on my soft, soft shoulder? Soft shoulder? Hey, look out! Hairpin turns up and down the mountainside. Hairpin turns, driving like a suicide. It's a hurty shame, but our love's about to flame out. Can't you tell my poor heart yearns? But you keep on riding them hairpin turns. Yes, you just keep on riding them hairpin. Get your tongue off that gas pedal, baby. You're trying to love this thing or drive it? Well, then drive it. Drive it. Just because you ain't got nothing to live for. Heck, come to think of it, I ain't got nothing either. Hell, you don't know something? I'm beginning to like it. Hairpin turns up and down the mountainside. Hairpin turns, driving like a suicide. I know you ain't to blame, but our love's about to flame out. Can't you smell the rubber burn as you keep riding them hairpin turns? Golly Mountain Blues. So I recommend you go listen to Bill do that. Let's see. Is there a couple more I can read? I'm going to read a couple
from the big book here.
And then I have one poem I'm going to read, one that I wrote. So let's see. Are we okay on time?
Yeah, please.
Okay. Yeah. Let's see. There's another poem. Yeah. Another poem about his mother. What's the poem where the coat hangers are in the closet?
The closet. The closet. It's called the closet. And yeah. It's in the index.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm just looking for, maybe it's under the closet, 51. Okay. This is an absolutely beautiful poem. Well, as I say, there's too many beautiful poems. So, the closet, after my mother's death. Here, not long enough after the hospital happened, I find her closet lying empty and stop my play and go in and crane up at three black wire hangers which quiver, airy, released. They appear to enjoy their new distance, cognizance born of the absence of anything else. The closet has been cleaned out full flush as surgeries where the hangers could be amiable scalpels, though they just as well would be themselves in basements, glovelessly scraping uteri. But here, pure, transfigured heavenward, there birds whose wingspans expand by excluding me. Their range is enlarged by loss. They'd leave buzzards mealy as moths, and the hat shelf is even higher, as the sky over a prairie, an undotted desert where nothing can swoop sudden, crumple in secret. I've fled at ambush, tag, age, six. Must I face this? Can I have my hide and seek hole back now, please? The clothes, the thicket of shoes, where is it? Only the hangers are at home here. Come heir to this rare element, fluent. Their skeletal grace sings of the ease with which they let go the dress, slip, house coat, or blouse, so absolvingly. Free, they fly trim, triangular. Augurs leapt ahead from some geometric god who soars stripped of flesh, it is said. Catnip. To a brat placated by model airplane kits, kids my size lack motor skills for. I wind up all glue scabbed, pawing goo goo fingernails, glazed skins fun to peer in as frosty glass doors. But the closet has no windows. Opaque or sheer, I must shut my eyes, shrink within to peep into this wall. Soliciting sleep, I'll dream, mother, spilled and cold, unpillowed, the operating table cracked to goad delivery, its stirrups slack, its forceps closed. By it, I'll see mobs of obstetrical personnel kneel proud, congratulatory, cooing and ooing and hold the dead infant up to the dead woman's face as if for approval. The prompted, beholding tears, a zoom shot kiss. White masked doctors and nurses patting each other on the back, which is how in the Old West a hangman, if he was good, could gauge the heft of his intended. Awake, the hangers are sharper, knife and slice. I jump helplessly to catch them, to twist them clear, misshape them whole, sail them across the small air space of the closet. I shall find room enough here by excluding myself. By excluding myself, I'll grow. So this is a poet who, though many people loved his work, didn't get a lot of attention from the reviewers. Of course, the sad part is he's getting it now. But I guess it's good when the worm turns. And let me read some pages to you. This is called In Memory. It's pretty much, I think this is pretty much a first draft poem. But because I didn't get in the trickster stuff and I didn't get in the erotic stuff, what I want to call Bill's erotic acrobatics. But here's something that you might know, you might be interested in. In Memory. My heart leaps up when I see Bill Knott's selected poems. I am flying into myself. Receive a rave review in the New York Times, followed 2 days later by a poem of his selected for the Times magazine. Let's not forget that he had to die to get this kind of attention after a lifetime of writing astounding and beautiful and deeply moving original poems that very few paid attention to. Very few, at least, in the places where reputations are made in poetry. But as one of the reviewers said, his reputation didn't depend on his death. It was the poems that finally are making readers pay attention. The poems that he gave away on the internet or in stapled books that he sent to friends. I remember how thrilled I was whenever Bill sent me a pile of these books with lavish inscriptions telling me what a great poet I am. I'm not a great poet, but I know a great poet when I see one. I saw that great poet in Bill. Back in the 70s, I badgered him for a book that I could publish with my small press called Sun. He gave me selected and collected poems that came out in 1977. He was easy to work with. He came over and Phyllis made him her wonderful chicken dinner, and we talked about the book. Later, he told James Randall that he wanted to do a selected poems, but only wanted it to be 55 pages long. One publisher told me, Bill said, that I can't do that. It has to be 120 pages to be a selected poems. So I went with Bill Zawadzki, and I picked my 55 pages, and we picked the rest to make the collected part. So it's really two books in one. That's pretty much how I remember it, too. Selected and collected poems came in at 121 pages. I didn't like the portrait that Bill gave me for the book jacket. A mopey scowl. I also didn't like the copy that read, "He is currently unemployed and looking for a job." But he insisted. I was so elated to be publishing him that I couldn't say no. The works in progress that he also announced on the book jacket never appeared. Cactus Beer, a novel, and a new book of poems entitled, "I Would Prefer Not To." With the puns and the reference to Melville's story, Bartleby, it's too bad the title got lost. Bill's readings were extraordinary. I think I heard him read twice, once at the dance theater workshop, a stunning reading. I sat in the balcony looking down at him at the podium. He waved his hands as if he were the conductor of his feelings, whipping up our feelings. I thought he might rise to the ceiling, take all of us with him to wherever poetry can bring us, another world, but always this one. Afterwards at dinner, I sat next to Tom Lux, who only wanted to talk about baseball. Bill ordered his usual two cups of hot tea and a glass full of ice, then made iced tea for the crazy diet he was always on, which required that he consume large amounts of fluids. Then I heard him read at the Poetry Project. He was in total control of the audience and in total control of his poetry. He played with it as he read it, repeating lines and phrases as if seized by a sense of wonder that he had written them. He gave you the feeling that he loved what he had written, caressing it, stretching it out, slowly removing its undergarments as he spoke. Most of his listeners must have felt that. Must have felt that too. I know I did. Hearing these readings was a spiritual experience. His poetry could do anything, make you laugh or weep or feel sexy or so inspired that the wonder was that the whole world didn't rush to hear him or to publish whatever he wrote. After the reading, a group of us headed towards the Orchidea, the bar and restaurant on the corner of 10th Street across from the church. But Bill had to go somewhere. I eavesdropped as Allen Ginsberg cornered Bill, complimenting him for such a fantastic reading, but urged him to move away from the self-deprecation. Bill nodded his head, saying, "Thanks, thanks," and then was on his way. That night he missed Allen singing Coleman Hawkins' solo on Body and Soul, there in the booth where we drank and ate hamburgers. Bill came over to my apartment when Selected and Collected Poems came out to sign copies. He signed every copy with hilarious dedications. "To you, unknown reader, and all the nights we never spent together. To Marilyn Monroe, wishing that we could meet again this weekend at the Plaza. When several years later I had to take Sun out of business, the press, I donated many of these signed copies to Poets House, which used them as premiums for new members. I hope whoever got one appreciated it." The last time I saw Bill was when he read at KGB on the Lower East Side, reading that you arranged. He was as brilliant as ever, and we were able to say hello as if no time had gone by at all. Which is why I was shocked when I checked into his blog site one day, something I did regularly, to find a headline in which he accused me of not paying him royalties. Bill was good at shooting from the hip, but had forgotten that when I closed down Sun, I turned the rights to the books I'd published back to the authors. Mary Carr had written a nostalgic review in the Washington Post, I think, in which she talked about how important Bill's work had been to her. She quoted from poems in Selected and Collected Poems, and for some reason put in a copyright notice that said, "Copyright, see, Sun, 1977. Bill jumped to the conclusion that I had been stealing his money. I wrote to him immediately and reminded him of our agreement, that he had owned the rights to his poems when Sun disappeared in 1985. "What can I do? I'm so sorry," he wrote to me. "You can take down that headline and dump what you've written immediately. I love you and I love your work, and I've never stolen a penny from you and never would." 5 minutes later, when I went back to look at Bill's blog, the article was gone. We believe that those we love will always be available to us. But when death suddenly robs us of someone like Bill, the grim truth of life cuts us in the face again. I would prefer not to acknowledge his death. And as long as I have his books, as long as I remember him, I won't have to. Thank you. Thank you. And thank you, Star, for inviting me. And thank you, Cameos, for doing this.
Thanks, everybody, for coming, and thank you, Bill, and thank you, Marianne, for having this idea. I just want to close with a poem about poetry and how it lives beyond corporal life, shall we say. "The sliding doors are not what I seek. They are too bashful and unalarmed. They cannot touch me like your arms or listen to my silences while I sleep. They are too bashful and unalarmed to hear the heartbeats within the trees or listen to my silences while I sleep as our fears unwind in quiet relief. To hear the heartbeats within the trees is more than thought or contemplation, as our fears unwind in quiet relief, what is not contained by only reason. More than thought or contemplation, more than the air we love and breathe, is what is not contained by only reason. whenever we meet and fall asleep. Thank you for coming.
That's yours.
Yeah, I want to thank our wonderful audience. Thank you for making this celebration possible by being here. Star Black is a wonderful poet. Bill Zavatsky is a wonderful poet. We have collections of their own work. And we're so grateful to both of you for bringing Bill Knott out and around us again. So it's with great gratitude that I salute both of you and our audience and welcome you to linger and chat and buy some books. So another round of applause for our poets.